Hello and welcome to the Funds Fanatic Show. I'm very pleased to be joined on our first podcast of 2022 by River and Mercantile Fund Manager Dan Hambury. Dan runs the firm's UK Equity Income Fund, but it's perhaps small caps which are closest to his heart, as he also heads up the £630 million River and Mercantile UK Equity Smaller Companies Fund, all of which should give us plenty to discuss when it comes to the UK stock market and the outlook for 2022. Dan, thanks for joining us.
Oh, good afternoon, Jeremy. Thanks for having me on.
Fantastic. So UK equities have performed pretty well in the last year or so during the vaccine rally and so-called reopening trade. From where you're sitting, what's the outlook look like for the year ahead?
Yeah, as you say, the equity market's made very good progress since the nadir in March 20. And over the past year, it's up about 14%, which is a bit sluggish relative to other areas of the world, actually. Some parts of the world obviously Down over 20%. And in fact, the small and mid-cap space within the UK market actually did deliver about 20% last year. So very good return. And that obviously leaves us gazing into our crystal balls at the beginning of 2022, asking what's going to come next. And I think there's two ways of looking at it. First of all, obviously, we're highly correlated with other global markets. And we know that the US market dominates global markets and has been on an amazing tear, really, for a number of years. And so a large part of our own success will be driven by what the US market does. We can't get away from that. And of course, that leads us then to thinking about what's going to create further tailwinds or indeed headwinds for the markets from here. And I'm sure we'll touch on some of the sort of macro indicators later. But I think my starting point with the UK equity market, it is at a relatively big discount in the context of history to global markets. We've all been waiting, as you know, for some kind of turnaround in the relative rating of the UK market. That hasn't occurred yet. But certainly I was of the view that post-Brexit, that there would be a period of indigestion probably in terms of thinking about economic growth. And, you know, it may be that as we start to look through the slower growth of the last two or three years, that we might start to see a slightly brighter outlook for the UK economy. We've got a cheap currency. And of course, the markets are very international. The UK equity market is very international. 75% of profits are overseas. So we're actually really more driven by the global economy and also by the index constituents, so the actual sector makeup of the market. And of course, we've actually got more of a cyclical market than many markets globally, certainly versus the US market. And we've also got a number of sort of more deep cyclical type businesses. And with inflation picking up, usually those sort of value markets tend to do a bit better in a relative sense. So when you put all that together, I think after the strong recent performance in markets, I think it would be a brave man to say we're going to have another stonking year like we did the last 2 years. But you know, when you look at it compared to bond markets, property, you know, cash, when there's this inflation about, I think a value equity market like the UK market is a pretty good, sensible place to put your money right now.
Thanks, Dan. Well, a lot to think about there. But is it fair to say then that, you know, all the conditions are still in place for the UK market to go on and deliver at least a bout of modest outperformance, perhaps?
Yeah, it's very difficult to see what the kind of catalyst is, as it were. In terms of what will drive outperformance of the UK market. One of the things that we've been postulating actually is since Brexit is that maybe global investors will start to look at the UK in the same way they looked at Japan many years ago when Japan got carved out of Asia and we started to talk about Asia ex Japan and Japan. And maybe we'll start to think, you know, when you're an Asian investor, a sovereign wealth fund, global investor, you'll be looking into Europe thinking maybe about continental Europe and the UK rather than sort of pan-European. And that will almost create in itself a new individual asset class, which will provide some interest, some diversification for those managers. So, I mean, that's more of a technical thing. That might be something that gets interesting. As I say, we've got a relatively cheap currency. When you look on a real effective exchange rate basis, the derating of sterling over the last few years hasn't really got better. So over sort of a 50-year period, we're still very much at the bottom of the range. So a competitive currency is obviously helpful. And you could argue that things can't get you'd hope things can't get a lot worse from a sort of political point of view in terms of how the world is viewing us at the moment. So I think all in all, it's always very difficult to put your finger on exactly what's going to turn things round. Arguably, you need better operating momentum, improving return on capital, and as well as that cheap valuation starting point to really get the UK stock market moving in the right direction relative to other equity markets.
Yeah. We, just coming back to something you referenced in your first answer, I mean, we're speaking in the second week of the year, and the first few trading days of 2022 were marked by a bit of a pullback in stocks in the US, particularly technology. Are you worried about contagion from the US market then?
Well, contagion in the sense that stock markets are correlated, yeah. Not necessarily contagion from the tech sector, which is obviously a huge part of the US market and has driven, you know, a huge part of their outperformance. You know, most of the upside in the US market has come from the big tech stocks, the FANG stocks plus others around those. So I'm not so worried about contagion there. I mean, I think, you know, what we've seen is obviously the bond yield rising. Investors, you know, look at the discount rates rising on these long duration stocks that are where a lot of the growth in the future value is a long way into the future, like typically, you know, you see with technology companies. So it would be very normal to see those stocks derating, those very highly rated stocks, as we see bond yields pushing up again, which we've just seen at the beginning of the year. As you know, there's, you know, the 10-year has moved up from sort 1.5% to 1.75% pretty rapidly. And that's what causes that derating. Of course, in the UK market, we don't have the same number of high growth stocks. No. At the margin, you see some rotation. Don't get me wrong. And actually, you know, what's quite interesting is the factor rotation you see in the market at times like this. It's been quite extreme, partly because I think we had a quiet period over Christmas and New Year, probably, and things weren't moving at that point. But you've had a very very significant factor rotation in the first couple of weeks of this year. Not too dissimilar to previous, you know, periods like, you know, the global financial crisis, where we had several weeks of really, really aggressive factor rotation. Or indeed, you know, when the Nasdaq bubble burst in 2000, you got that very aggressive rotation into value. Now, I personally don't think it's a repeat of that yet, but I think there has been. And of course, what we've certainly seen, we have a factor return model that helps drive a lot of our stock selection, as I'm sure other fund managers will use as well. And what we have seen over the last few years is a very high correlation with bond yields with those factor returns. So your classic valuation returns or momentum returns or growth or return on capital, these sorts of measures that in the past have maybe been quite uncorrelated, and when you put them together, give you actually a really nice risk-adjusted return. What we've seen is it's all been about the shape of the yield curve and being on the right side of that, and you've had to manage the risk around your portfolio, you know, in line with that, or you don't, and you take one of these more extreme views. There's funds out there that are super long duration, and the growth managers you've done very well over the past, or you might have some extreme value managers. But we tend to be quite pragmatic with our own risk management. And so we've had a few of those high growth stocks derating.
Yeah.
MaxCyte was our best performer in 2020. It went up 250%. Wow. This time last year, we were trying to sell it. It was quite illiquid. We sold quite a bit, between 10 and 12 pounds. When it fell below £9, we stopped selling it. However, it's continued on down. It's down at nearly, I think it's down at £6.50 now. So it's almost halved. That long duration stock. Now, we haven't sold it further. We think it's got great prospects. But, you know, that kind of derating that happens in those high growth stocks can be quite, you know, quite aggressive. Yeah. Even though there's been no particularly bad news out of the company. One has to be mindful of that and manage that depending on your time horizon.
Okay. Do you think, I mean, we're going to come and talk more about the individual funds, but just talking about the magnitude of the fall there, do you think amongst smaller companies, you know, these rotations happen more quickly, which also gives kind of more opportunity maybe to buy back in at the right time? Or
no, I don't think it happens more quickly in smaller companies. I think, liquidity, that there are times when the you know, less liquidity drives more extreme moves, for sure. But, you know, there's been some massive moves in large caps. I mean, you know, you only have to look at, you know, mining stuff. You know, we bought Anglo American at £10 in March 20, and then it hit £30 18 months later, and that's a FTSE 100 company that's trebled in a year and a half. So, you know, you get huge volatility in every part of the market, quite honestly. Yes, of course, you get some really big winners from smaller co. The small co's winners tend to be, you know, multi-baggers. They go on to grow to become big companies, and they can be more volatile. I think when liquidity dries up in the market, you do get maybe get some overreactions on the downside, for sure. But I think it's a misconception that small caps are kind of higher volatility, high risk. Often it's not the case, actually. A lot of the large caps are more leveraged businesses, more cyclical businesses, and often they're just as volatile, right. Actually.
Interesting. So, you know, we're talking across the UK equity income and smaller companies funds, which you run today. The latter is the bigger fund, and that hit its 15-year anniversary in November. You've run it for most of that time, and performance has been good. In fact, in the last 10 years, you're top of the UK smaller company sector with a 483% return. So what's the secret, I guess?
I think the secret of doing well in any job is a combination of skill, hard work, and a big dose of luck. Let's be clear, and that's the same, I think, when you're in any career, but particularly in financial markets. But if we just point to the skill bit to start with, clearly we implement an investment process, our PVT, potential valuation timing process, which is quite repeatable. It's very disciplined. It's bottom-up stock selection using a quant model, followed up with detailed fundamental research, and then sensible portfolio failure construction risk management. And it is pretty systematic, the way we sieve the market, the way we analyze companies. And it won't work in every short-term period. There will be 1 and 3 year periods when that process won't deliver, like any other investment process. But over the long run, it does seem to deliver very good, consistent returns. So, that's part of it. You need a good team around you, which I have. George Entzer is a fantastic fund manager in his own right, who works very closely with me on the smaller companies.
And
he's a micro cap specialist.
That's right.
He's a micro cap manager. And again, look at the benefits of that. He's there sieving all these sort of 400-odd companies, 400, 500 companies below where I would normally be looking, finding all the real gems. And then as his winners come through, we can buy them into the small cap fund. Well, that's a brilliant position to be in, to have that knowledge of those small, really small names. So there's that. We've got some great analysts that support George and I, who do fantastic work. Maya and Anna, Will, who's one of the other UK managers. They're all doing great work, doing the research that then feeds into these ideas. So, you need a good team. You absolutely need the right environment. You need the environment. So all of those things are important. You need people who are passionate about investment. They've got to really love it. They want to keep looking for new ideas, read stuff at the weekends. And that's something I've always found very interesting. I love the transparency of fund management. The ranking is very transparent. It gets away from, let's call it, the sales pitch, doesn't it? Although, of course, I'm doing a bit of that now with my podcast with you. But there are times when you need a bit of luck as well. I mean, I do feel for a lot of value managers over the last 10 years because, when I started my career as an investor, it was at the top of the dot-com bubble. And the value investors were 3 or 4 years into my career were the heroes, because they had outperformed very strongly as the Nasdaq bubble burst. And between 2000 and about 2005, value investors absolutely shot the lights out. And it has been really interesting, sort of in the second half of my career, watching the struggles of people trying to buy cheap stocks. And you think, well, surely that's how you make money, you buy cheap stocks. But of course, we've had this incredible environment of, negative real rates, the zero lower band of interest rates, which has created this ever re-rating of long duration growth stocks. So some of that, you could say, is that skill, should that have been foresight? But I mean, clearly there's a lot of luck involved there as well in the short term. I think what you've got to try and do as an active fund manager is demonstrate skill over a long period of time. And then maybe you can point to the fact you've been, you've done something right.
Yeah. There's definitely some stuff I'd like to pick up on there, but perhaps before we continue, perhaps you can just explain to us in layman terms what the process is, and maybe, one of the simplest ways to do that would be, how does your fund look different to the market or other funds perhaps?
Yeah. So at the heart of every investment decision we make, we've got three key cornerstones, if you like. We look for high potential companies that are going to create significant shareholder value. And our focus is very much around return on capital and growth in that particular fundamental pot, should we say. Also from a sustainable basis as well. We look for them to be undervalued, these companies. So clearly we have a valuation discipline. And then we look to pick them up at the right time. So there's a timing element, which is about improving operating momentum and improving share price. Share price trend can tell you a lot. The market can give you a lot of information. It's not always the other way around. So we combine PV and T all of the time, whether we're looking at buy ideas or sell ideas. But importantly, what we don't do is say we only want to buy high quality names, or we only want to buy recovery names. What we do is blend a range of different potential opportunities to make money. So we'll blend a number of high quality growth, recovery and asset backed businesses. And the key and what we're doing is that the metrics, the financial metrics that we're using to sieve for these companies are systematically different depending on the different category of company. So if I'm looking for a really great growth stock, I have to use a different set of metrics to maybe a recovery situation where it used to be a good stock, has fallen on hard times, might even be loss making at the moment. You can't analyze those two companies in the same way. You have to do it through a different lens. So essentially, we apply a different lens, and then there are the actual data. That's kind of philosophically what we're trying to do. What do we do in practice? Well, a lot of the heavy lifting gets done by our quant front end. We've got a very powerful database which sifts globally, you know, about 40,000 stocks. It whirs away over the weekend. It throws up a ranking list for us on a Monday morning. It doesn't pick the stocks for the portfolios. That is absolutely down to the combination of the analyst's work and the portfolio manager. But what it does do is give us an objective starting point. And one of the big dangers, as you know, in markets is fear and greed. It's that behavioral psychology aspect. And that's where a quant model can really help, if you like, tame some of those fears in the way you go about your work. But it is just the starting point in the quant. Just as important are the research analysts and the hard work they put in modeling the companies, getting to understand what the drivers are of the businesses and whether they're going to grow strongly or more strongly than the market expects, perhaps. Yeah. And then finally, timing is just really helpful, because no matter how good you are as an analyst or a fund manager at picking great companies, there are times when great companies underperform. I've just mentioned Maxite, you know, going down over the last 12 months. You know, if you'd bought Maxite 2 years ago, you're up over 100%. If you bought it a year ago, you're down 50%. It's the same company, but the market's just moved so dramatically, when arguably the company's made a lot of progress. So that's where timing is absolutely crucial. You do need that relative timing help, and sort of positive trend following. So we apply all of that. And then the other big thing is managing risk. You know, you don't know the future. We don't know what the future holds. We don't know what 2022 holds. So what we're always trying to do is say, let's buy lots of cheap insurance policies in our portfolio. Let's buy companies that might pay out if a certain scenario happens. If we think there's going to be geopolitical risk, maybe we want a defense stock, or maybe we want oil stocks to hedge against a high oil price. Maybe we want gold stocks because actually we're concerned about competitive currency devaluation. These stocks won't all do well all of the time, but if you can build a portfolio that pays out significantly in these different scenarios, you're kind of hedging yourself against the unknown. I'm a big fan of doing that rather than taking a very firm view on, I think this is going to happen in the future. I think that's quite dangerous as a portfolio manager.
Yeah, interesting. So, well, I'm going to put you on the spot now, if that's all right, and say I'm looking at the smaller companies fact sheet here, and I can see Diversified Energy is a top holding in the portfolio. It was at the end of November, about 2.5% position. Why is that? Tell me how the process churns that out as the kind of most exciting UK smaller company you can find.
Yeah. Well, it's more that actually we can't find a lot of other exciting companies in the energy space that we like that are high enough quality. So we're looking for energy exposure. We are very firmly focused on sustainability as a team and a business. And we are very conscious that fossil fuels are going to play a smaller role in the future than they are currently, in terms of driving the global economy. So at this point in time, we don't own any direct oil or coal stocks. But what we do also understand is that you can't just switch off fossil fuels. It's going to be decades and decades of using them. And our view is that good gas companies, providing there aren't significant methane leaks, are the cleanest way to access the oil and gas sector. Yeah. More importantly, with the diversified energy company is actually the cash flow profile. Because they actually are a consolidator of existing gas wells, essentially. So they're North American based. They buy up existing wells. So they own about 7,000 over in the US. And what you can do is plot a profile. There's a decline rate with a gas well where the gas over time falls as the pressure drops. But you can plot essentially quite an accurate cash flow profile of the company into the future. And that provides a very stable set of cash flows. They do a lot of hedging. The management very conservative. So they're hedging forward several years in the futures market with those gas prices. And so that gives you terrific visibility. And what's interesting about diversified gas is that it's trading actually very cheaply. It's got very high yield. It's because of this cash flow it throws off. It's had a sort of 10% dividend yield, which is attractive for both the income fund and the small cap fund. So what we like about it is the visibility on the existing cash flows. Rather than a lot of oil exploration companies, you're really relying on them, you know, hitting oil, if you like, finding the next big, the next big elephant, in, you know, and that's a punt we're not willing to take generally. So that's why you find us, we've got quite a big position in diversified energy, because actually we don't have a lot of direct energy exposure elsewhere in the portfolio.
Okay, thanks, Dan. You've mentioned having these kind of almost companies like insurance policies against this and that risk in the portfolio. And that's interesting you're hearing discussing the gold miners in that light. I think maybe in the equity income fund, there's Barrick Gold, Fresnillo, Centamin, a few names. One of the other absolutely big macro challenges out there is inflation and rising interest rates. What kind of insurance policies in the portfolio do you have against those?
Well, again, they're two different things. And obviously, you know, if we just think about gold provided a very strong hedge for us in 2020. Mm. We had very strong performance from the gold stocks in that year. We sold down about half the exposure. And since then, they've underperformed, actually, the ones we had left in the portfolio for the last 12 months. And in particular, more recently, we've seen real yields rising, which is typically seen is quite negative for gold. The reason we think that gold is actually going to be a very strong performer later this year and into the future is that actually the global economy is very leveraged. There's an enormous amount of credit. It's very difficult for it to sustain much higher yields and indeed interest rate rises. And what's really interesting is you're already seeing in this rapid rotation we've seen at the beginning of the year, you're already seeing the market pricing in 3 rate rises over in the US. In fact, Goldman Sachs came out this morning and said they think there's going to be 4. Now, if they're right, then I'm wrong on gold. Okay, and the economy can sustain 4 rate rises, then we're going to see even higher yields. Then I would say gold will continue to underperform. Now, the good news is if they're right, is the reason those rate rises are coming through is actually the economy is performing very strongly, and actually the stock market generally will do pretty well in that environment. And as long as you've got some cyclical exposure, you've got companies with pricing power. So typically companies with strong gross margins, for example, are really good at hedging inflation. But it's essentially companies with pricing power that can pass through prices to their end customers. That's what gives you the protection in that inflationary environment. Why I think gold will do well is that what will actually occur here is that we might see a couple of interest rate rises. And whilst there'll be inflation expectations will be very volatile, you know, this whole argument between being structural inflation and transient. Obviously, there's clearly a bit of both there at the moment, or quite a lot of both, I should say. How much of it's to do with supply chains, etc., we can debate till the cows come home. But you know, the long end of the yield curve is probably going to be pretty volatile, would be my guess. What I think will happen, though, is I think the Fed will pull back from forecasting many rate rises. I think we might get a couple, but I don't think we'll get many after that. And I think the moment they pull back from that and the market sees that and people are then looking through, I would have thought the long end of the yield curve will already be looking through to a cyclical slowdown and you'll start to see your yields fall again. I think in that environment, gold does extremely well. Gold's really lagged. And I think a lot of the gold was only down 4% in dollar terms last year, but gold stocks, most of them derated almost 50% relative. You don't need much strength in the gold price to make some serious money in these very cheap names. So listen, is that your central view? Do you bet your portfolio on that? Absolutely not. Just to be clear, I've only got about 5% of the income fund in gold stocks. And I've only got about 2-3% of the small cap fund. I have been adding, you mentioned Centamin, that's the most recent purchase actually. So what we're not talking about, you know, swinging the bat on the whole portfolio, but we're just saying, actually, if we have that insurance policy, which is, off, you know, it can be like a 5% premium, if that doubles, because actually other areas of the portfolio are struggling, that's really helpful at smoothing the returns in the portfolio. And that's what you're looking for.
Okay, very, very interesting narrative there. Let's move on a bit more to talk about the portfolios and where you've been finding interesting opportunities. I suppose where have you been finding value in the UK market recently? Maybe we can split that into kind of large companies first and then move on to the smaller companies.
Yeah, I mean, large caps, it's
value across the board, is it?
It's slightly dull in some senses. I mean, it sounds that's an awful thing to say. But what we're looking for is some of the big cap, cheap companies where actually we're starting to see various operational improvement, maybe catalyst to actually realise some of that value. So we've been adding back to good old-fashioned names like British American Tobacco, GlaxoSmithKline, Lloyds Bank. These are cheap companies where actually you're seeing some kind of positive change in those companies. Mm. You know, it might be a repositioning of the tobacco companies into next gen products, and the fact that you've got a higher dividend yield than your PE, and they're starting to deliver upgrades. It might be Lloyds Bank, where you're getting a steepening yield curve. They've gone through a massive transformation at Lloyds. They're doing a lot of things right, and they're actually starting to deliver better numbers. Glaxo is in a really interesting sort of special situation now, in terms of potentially demerging one of its largest businesses. What I call, these are classic old-fashioned stocks that have been left behind over the last few years, where you wouldn't buy all of them, but maybe where things are starting to look up. But as you can tell, I'm buying across a number of different sectors there. There's also some, so that would be the sort of large cap end. I mean, we're always looking to get into really high quality names that have derated significantly. So we bought Reckitt Benckiser, for example, for the first time in, I can't remember the last time I owned Reckitt, but bought that in the autumn, because Reckitt's had derated from sort of 24 times to 16 times. And we did quite a lot of work on it, and actually think that the turnaround they've been working on for the last couple of years is probably going to succeed. And I can see that business actually gaining traction and really starting to see its organic growth rates pick up again in the future. And I think then it'll re-rate back to being, you know, a much more highly rated sort of classic staples stock. So we do look for opportunities like that as well. So that would be the large cap. And then on the small cap, there's always a myriad of great ideas. You know, we've been buying cheap industrial companies like Essentra, for example, which is an interesting breakup story. It was a company that we've engaged with the last couple of years on a number of things. But
what have you been engaging with them on?
But interestingly, well, we're engaging around, actually, they've got a number of businesses. They've got a world-class components business, which is the one they want to focus on. But they've also got a filters business and a packaging business. And one of the areas we engaged with around packaging was just whether they could, you know, whether they could evolve the model and look to do a bit more recycling. Okay. So they do things like packaging for, you know, like if you go and buy a packet of tablets from Boots and the packet around the tablets, you know, you've got a nice crisp packet. There wasn't a lot of recycled cardboard going into any of these, and we were asking, you know, we were suggesting that best in class packaging companies are now adding a lot more recycling in. And anyway, what's interesting is that nothing to do with our engagement, I should think, but probably more to do with a strategic review, they've actually decided to try and break the group up and focus on components. And we think the sum of the parts means there's quite a lot of upside there, which will now be realized probably a bit faster than maybe we had first thought when we bought the shares. So that's a good, you know, that's a good example of a sort of value stock. I've mentioned Centamin adding back to the gold exposure. I think this recent sell-off in gold and the underperformance of the stocks is actually throwing up a really nice opportunity to start rebuilding positions there. So Centamin is one we've been building more recently, after having, you know, they had a couple of years of some pretty bad stuff. Well, yeah, they've had a pretty difficult couple of years because they had one of the big walls in their main mine in Egypt collapsed, and it created a big problem in their production profile. But we think they're on top of that now, and the guidance is set sensibly. So that would be another area. What else have we been? We bought Atrato On-Site Energy.
Okay.
So one of the companies that we own is Supermarket Income REIT, which is one of the few REITs that we own, real estate investment trusts. Supermarket Income REIT are specialised in owning land that they then lease to Tesco's, Sainsbury's, Morrison's and Waitrose. So rock solid.
We're talking giant superstores here, aren't we?
Giant superstores. They're big multi-channel. They target the big out-of-town multi-channel stores, where they're a kind of, you know, retailer at the front, they're a click and collect operation in the middle, and an Amazon warehouse at the back doing deliveries, essentially. They've been doing some great work in that space. And, you know, one of the things that they were doing to help the supermarkets hit their net zero targets was put solar panels on the roofs of the big superstores. Now, that's a big undertaking, but it's a bit of a no-brainer for these supermarkets because they use a lot of electricity, particularly to keep things cold. As you know, they've got big freezers and fridges in supermarkets, and 4% of the UK's electricity consumption goes to is actually supermarkets, believe it or not. So it's really important they try and cut that, to hit their own targets. And so putting solar panels on the roofs is a really interesting way of doing that. And it economically, it really makes a lot of sense. So they identified this as an opportunity. And what they've done is they've actually brought in a new expert management team and launched a new trust called Atrato On-Site Energy. They raised £150 million and we participated in that. And essentially, they're now the largest commercial installer of solar panels onto commercial buildings in the UK. So all your big FTSE companies like Unilever and Glaxo and all these guys that have got, you know, 25 odd massive offices and buildings around the country, they're a market now. They're a target for Atrato, and you can get very decent returns. There's very little technology risk. There's very little competitive risk at the moment. So what that gives you is a bit like supermarket income. It gives you a very steady yield, steady growth. It's not going to shoot the lights out when there's a bull market in stocks, right? It's probably going to lag the market. But when these stocks really come into their own is they give you an index-linked diversifier that maybe bonds once gave us many years ago, but now with bonds with negative real yields aren't really protecting our capital in the same way. This kind of stock is a really important diversifier in people's portfolios. So, you know, we look at things like supermarket income, things like Atrato On-Site Energy as being, again, these, they provide insurance policies. If you get a bear market phase, these companies will outperform strongly in all likelihood.
Oh, well, okay, really interesting there. Supermarkets was something I'm keen to ask about quickly, actually, because Tesco is one of your biggest positions in the income fund. I think you might own Sainsbury's too.
Yeah, we do.
Of course, the takeover of Morrisons by private equity buyers was a major story last year, and I've seen analysts commenting that Sainsbury's, maybe even Tesco, might not be too big to be bid for. What do you think?
I think that's probably true. I mean, the private equity funds these days have enormous firepower, don't they? And we've seen Morrisons obviously go, Asda obviously is the other one, obviously, which was also snapped up. So, I mean, there's a number of different aspects to it. I guess the headlines would be, first of all, they have got quite a lot of real estate backing, and that's attractive in this low interest rate environment. And that's obviously, you know, supermarket income rates a good example of sort of trying to extract that value. But, you know, the supermarkets themselves sit on quite a lot of real estate. The second thing is one of the unfortunate, results of the high energy inflation that we've seen over the last 12 months or so is that we are going to see, I think, and also climate change, we're going to see probably a reasonably sustained period of food price inflation. Yeah. And we've started to see it a little bit at the margin. But that is problematic. Food, if you combine energy inflation and food price inflation, that starts to make life very difficult for a large proportion of the population, particularly the lowest income households. I think I read today that about a third of households in the UK are very concerned about being able to afford their gas bills next year. Food price inflation is going to be another problem. The problem with high energy inflation, it feeds through to ammonia, fertilizers. We've had some really bad weather and variable weather around the world that are impacting things like wheat yields. Certainly coffee is really interesting at the moment. You watch the price of coffees moved up very dramatically last year, and I think will go higher. And that's largely because the big coffee producing nations are having a very difficult time at the moment, Brazil being the sort of main one. So food price inflation has all sorts, a bit like people always focus on the oil price, but food price inflation can have a lot of quite nasty knock-on effects into the rest of the economy as well. Supermarkets are a great hedge on that, believe it or not. They're very highly correlated with food price inflation, 90% correlated.
So they benefit from food price inflation.
They tend to when food price inflation is higher than core inflation, they tend to outperform.
Okay.
And that would be one macro driver. The reason we actually bought those stocks in the first place wasn't because we were making some big call on food price inflation, I should add. It was more about the recovery situation at Tesco. We actually originally bought Tesco in 2014. So it's been a long-term holding, and we've been watching the recovery of that business with interest, because you might recall it had been kind of written off. There was, you know, Aldi and Lidl were going to kill them in the marketplace. Amazon were coming in with Amazon Fresh. Yeah. These companies were dead, you know, and as a result, they were rated as if they were dead. Tesco's margins had gone from 6% to 2%. And then we started to see the turnaround under Dave Lewis, who came in from Unilever, and then that's continued with the new management team. So, Yeah, I mean, there's a number of things there, but we still think that the Tesco story is playing out very nicely at the moment, and it delivers a strong yield and is a good holding within the staples area. It's actually a relatively cheap stock that we can play in the income fund.
Okay, thanks, Dan. Last question from me. Another mini theme in your portfolios, I think, is these companies which are underrated in terms of their environmental credentials or the role they can play in the energy transition. I think Volution's one name you've mentioned before, but can you talk about that trend a bit more?
Yeah, so we're not experts at identifying the next big green tech winners. I wish we were. I mean, I think that the innovation wave that we're now going to see around decarbonisation is really exciting. It's going to be probably similar to, you know, the tech innovation wave of the last 20 years. We're going to now see this in decarbonising the economy globally. And I think that's going to throw up some amazing investment opportunities. We're going to see some amazing, innovation and change, which is always really exciting as an investor to look at that. I think where we think we're better placed as an investment team is probably to try and find existing profitable companies that are trying to transition and become, if you like, greener. And if we can get ahead of the market on that, we think that provides an opportunity to maybe pick up stocks where the growth rates are going to be a bit higher than the market expects. We get earnings upgrades and you get a re-rating. You mentioned Volution. We bought Volution Group a couple of years ago. That's a good example. They're a market leader in fans into the building industry. And where Volution historically would have been seen as a pretty high quality cash generative business, but actually ultimately just a cyclical building business. When you start to look at the legislation coming behind decarbonising homes and commercial buildings, you start to realise that there's going to be some very significant change there. And if we can find companies that can benefit from that, we're likely to do quite well. So the reason fans become important is because, as you know, legislation in 2025 is going to stop house builders putting gas boilers into new houses. And there's going to be a gradual push to try and move people over to greener energy sources, such as air source heat pumps or ground source heat pumps. And if you start putting air source heat pumps into the buildings, then they don't work as well. They're not as efficient in terms of throwing out heat as gas boilers. So you need better insulation. If you have better insulation, in order that the environment in the home is pleasant and isn't stuffy, you need better ventilation. And so suddenly the ventilation specialists like Volution Groups see their demand go up relative to where it was before. And what you find with these companies is that they might be growing along at GDP, or if they're a market leader, maybe a GDP plus one or plus two type company. So they might be growing at 4 or 5% annually. And as a result, they attract a certain rating in the market. Maybe they attract a market rating of 13 or 14 times. And then the growth rate accelerates to 6 or 7%. Or 8% because of that additional driver. Yeah. What happens is the market catches onto that new growth rate and goes, ooh, this is a growth stock, and they re-rate the stock. Suddenly you find that stock's trading on 25 times and you've not actually done a lot, really. They haven't actually delivered much of the growth yet, but the stock moves up in anticipation of that future growth. So what we're trying to... That's a good example. We've got other companies in the portfolio like smart metering systems. You know, smart meters are at the heart of the decarbonisation of the UK economy. It's a big part of government policy. We buy retailers where we're seeing that they're doing lots of fantastic stuff around recycling. Or, you know, DFS Furniture is one of the most advanced in terms of nearshoring. They're not shipping leather from South America to China to have it built into a sofa and brought over to the UK, which is actually not very sustainable. They're already a lot of their supply chain is nearshored in both the East Midlands in the UK and also in Eastern Europe. And so we're looking for, I guess we're looking for companies. Strix is another example. Biffa. We've got quite a few names in the portfolio. I could talk to a dozen different names where maybe at face value, you look at them and go, well, that sounds like a pretty standard, boring company. Why are you interested in that one? And actually what we think we've found is that there are some particular actions that management taking strategy, you know, that are actually going to accelerate the growth rate. And a lot of the time we're looking for, you know, the government subsidies and the regulation becoming tailwinds for these companies to drive that growth. And we think that's a really interesting growth theme now for the next, probably the rest of my investment career, I'd have thought.
Okay, well, thanks, Dan. On that future-friendly note, perhaps that's a good point to wrap things up. So, Dan, thanks very much for joining me today. And it's great to learn more about what you do.
Thanks, Jeremy. Good luck for 2022.
Thank you very much. Same to you.